Katan opening the sutra.
Why do we put on the seven panel robe at the sound of the bell, right? That's the punch. It's only, I think, a one-liner. It's sort of so-and-so asked, why do we put it on? Okay.
The world is vast and wide, right?
Yes, it is. So, what does it mean to be a Buddhist? A fairly technical answer would be that in our Zen tradition, a Buddhist is someone who studies the precepts, Sozaraksu, and acknowledges those precepts as the guiding principle of their lives in the Jukai ceremony. In fact, several of you will be doing that in a few weeks at our retreat. However, there are also many people in this country who haven't taken refuge in the precepts, and who may not even have read the precepts, who still consider themselves to be Buddhists, usually because they have some type of meditation practice, and they see their lives as inspired and informed by the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. Of course, this is very different from many of the Asian cultures, where a person may be born into a Buddhist family, and where Buddhism is an integral part of the culture, just as Christianity is in this country. Many of those persons are devotional Buddhists, who don't have a personal meditation practice, but who either pray to the Buddha themselves, or who hope to acquire merit by supporting the monks who practice and pray. Therefore, just as with Christianity and Judaism and most other religions, what Buddhism is and what it means to be a Buddhist can vary radically from culture to culture, from sect to sect, and from person to person. Buddhism has had 500 more years than Christianity to develop divergent sects, and we have put the time to good use. If that is true, perhaps we should view the question of what it means to be a Buddhist in an existential way. The meaning of being a Buddhist is just the meaning that each person imbues it with, as we do when we act to take refuge in the precepts. Taking that approach, we have the opportunity to make a profound commitment to awaken in each moment, and to use that moment-to-moment awareness to be cognizant of our actions in relationship to the precepts and to the one body. Zazen has a central role in that process. It is through that practice that we grow more awake, helping us to connect our actions with our understanding of the precepts. Being awake and working to live in accord with the precepts, can we say that is the essence of our way? As we come to understand the endless ramifications and the profound formless depths of the simple intentions to take up the way of not killing, of not stealing, of not being greedy, of not being angry, of not being stingy, and so on, we begin to see those as describing the life of a bodhisattva. Beyond manifesting the precepts, is there anything else we really need to do? I should include a little disclaimer here. Recently, I read a blog by Dosho Port decrying the fact that boomer teachers have de-emphasized the focus on realization that many of the teachers in earlier generations has set forth as the essential core of Zen. I suppose that I am guilty on both counts, as I told Dosho in a personal reply to his post. Being born in 1946, I was in the vanguard of the post-war baby boom, and I definitely tend to speak about qualities like loving-kindness and adherence to the precepts as the primary foci of our practice. I view my daily practice through the lens of my ability to be kind to all beings and to adhere to the precepts. And personally, I continuously fail at that enormous challenge. On the other hand, I would never say that realization isn't central to this process. Awakening to the reality of the one body and thereby rendering our ego self a little less solid is a profound change that makes the needs of other beings closer and more immediate. In a sense, realization is the core of our effort to turn our skin inside out. When my skin is inside out, what is important, what is the me that I am working to protect and benefit, is the whole universe. If this is truly what our practice should be about, do we need to be Buddhists? Do we need to chant, hold services, and bow repeatedly? Do we need to put on robes and raksus? Do we need altars with images of Shakyamuni or Manjushri? Do we need to bang on a wooden han or a densho bell, or even invite the bell to ring? Do we need to chant the Gata of Atonement or the Four Great Vows? Obviously, the answer is no. We can freely practice Zazen and work and live in according with the teachings of the Buddha without any of these trappings. Why then do we have them? I am convinced that a significant portion of the persons who come to our center only once or twice and decide not to return do so because they're turned off by these forms, and perhaps by the fact that there's a teacher sitting in front of the Zendo, eliciting their deepest fears of being controlled by a guru. I don't want to minimize the discomfort that many people feel just having to be sitting still and focusing on their breath. But I do believe that while at best many newcomers see our practices as strange, at worst, our rituals may awaken associations with their earlier exposure to religion, where prohibitions against idolatry were strong. Or perhaps they are now fleeing from the structure of that religious upbringing, and therefore they do not wish to bow and show obeisance before anyone, in spite of our explaining that they are not bowing to the historical Buddha or to a god, but rather to their own Buddha nature. Because of my interest in making the Dharma accessible, I often ask myself this question about the forms. Without the forms, could we still have Zen that is authentic, where people practice Zazen assiduously, both throughout the year and in rigorous sessions? Can we still have Zen where koan study remains strong in the context of the teacher-student encounter in Daisan? Can we still work to manifest loving kindness and compassion while wearing our normal attire? Would we respect teachers any less if they didn't sit in front of the room? When I have raised these questions in the Zendo before, the most common response I have heard from treetop students is that they enjoy the chanting and they feel that bowing helps their practice of humility. However, today I want to press further with this question. Are those reasons enough in the face of the possibility that those may also drive away persons who may be sincerely seeking what our practice has to offer? If we make this decision based on our enjoyment of chanting, which way is our skin turned? If we find bowing to be a valuable practice, what prevents us from practicing tens, hundreds, or thousands of times in our own homes? in 21st century America is the standard answer to the koan about the seven panel robe, that we put it on at the sound of the bell simply because we do, that there is no why, still adequate? Does the explanation that we are simply acting in accord with tradition provide sufficient support for our forms in this time, when there is such great suffering and so many people are seeking what the Dharma can offer? Furthermore, should we even consider ourselves to be Buddhists? Being a Buddhist can be a trap. What do people imagine when they hear that someone is a Buddhist? Many people have the conception that Buddhists are calm, peaceful, kind, compassionate, patient, and forbearing. If we believe that myth, and it's hard not to because it's so pervasive, we can fall into a heavenly being state, believing ourselves to be different and better than non-Buddhists. That is a pernicious self-deception. In fact, we are no better. We are just human beings attempting moment to moment to manage this wild and crazy juxtaposition of human nature and Buddha nature that is the heart of our being. Please consider this matter well. Take this koan into your heart and make it personal. Why do you put on your seven-paneled robe at the sound of the bell?
I'm one of those people who might have been turned away by the ritual if I had come in at another time than when I came in. And I find myself bowing to people in the grocery store. And it comes naturally. And it helps me to be, even though I'm not doing it, it's just a flow. But it enriches me, as well as, I hope, you know, I don't even think about it, but I just know that it wakes me up in the grocery store. So I think there is some value. I don't know. I think it's a fine balance. And I think there's a readiness when the student comes.
I don't have that much experience with the rituals, but I feel that they support the whole thing. It would be harder to do the core practice without all the things that surround it. You know, it just somehow it just somehow gives support to it. I don't know how to describe it better than that.
I've been away for a long time, but when I was here and practicing regularly, I had a lot of realizations from the actions of the physical motion of the kenhin, or tending the altar, or ringing the bell, because they tied into koans I was working on, or they tied into just the base principles of what we study here. And I'm very kinesthetic. I'm an active learner. So sometimes the words are harder for me to access, but the physical motion of what we do, I could understand. So those things were very important for me, to understanding some of the principles that we're practicing here.
When I was sitting over in Deborah's seat and got to, you know, interface with all the new people that came in and kind of explain to them what we do, I'd always be a little self-deprecating about it and say, you know, we do some weird things here. but we hold it lightly, you know, that They're important to us. They provide the container for our practice. They give us unity as a group and flow once people sort of realize where they fit into everything. But none of it sort of supersedes any one of us here, and I think we've proven that over time as we've innovated when we've needed to. I think, you know, there's a real naturalness to the fact that, you know, we're not as rigid as some places, but we're more so than others, and you know, I think we've come by that pretty honestly. And I've got nothing against places that are more formal than we are. In fact, they can be quite lovely. But there is the danger of letting the form become more important than the people, and becoming so rigid that you're pushing people out, sort of, in an aware sense. You know, I think if somebody comes and visits and never comes back, we never know why they didn't come back. But if somebody says to you, oh, I can't sit on the floor because I have pain or whatever, and you say, oh, you know, push past it or whatever, you know, that's a coldness that I think we don't have here, which I appreciate.
Kind of reminds me of when I was a therapist and I'd have somebody come once and never come back. You know, one time somebody says, oh, I got what I wanted, you know, or whatever. So you never know. You never know what motivated them to come in the first place. And we don't know what makes them not come back.
To me, it's important that I choose to do this, do the the rituals. They feel like a framework that doesn't change much, and things happen within that framework that you can't really predict. But I've always felt it good to have something that you know what to expect, you can count on. And the fact that we come here and we choose to do these things together, I think is very important. You're mentioning the very formal rituals. Reminds me of going to St. John's Episcopal Church to a gorgeous, gorgeous ceremony with beautiful music. The altar was stupendous. And my primary feeling on leaving after the service was how seductive it was, and how someone could get lost in that, in just the beauty of it. Now, maybe it wouldn't interfere with understanding or growing, but I think it would be very easy to get lost in that and not go and not push yourself, not go any further.
I think that can be very easy to do in Zen.
Anywhere, yeah.
Well, anything.
Yeah.
And yet, I really appreciate your metaphor. Is it a metaphor? I think so. Of skin inside out and being really wanting to be a place where those people who are searching can feel it, can come to.
I really like the two ideas that here. One is that of choosing to be here and choosing to participate. That voluntary bringing myself to, and also the holding it lightly. For me, I can't separate practice from psychology. And I don't come here to get therapy, but I can't separate those two. And some of the formalities will push personal buttons of mine. And when I hear that, holding it lightly, and I feel it heavily, I realize I'm the one that's holding it heavily. Mm. And it lets me see that. And that's not something in the world, that's something that keeps me from letting to the world. And that's very useful to me.
It does create those opportunities for us, doesn't it? You know, one of my favorite things, and I hate to talk about Dan because he's not here, but I will. Anyway, Dan tells a story about how, you know, he used to sit at Zen Mountain Monastery, and Dan's a pretty formal, you know, very rigid guy in his physicality, although he's not necessarily that way personally. But, you know, he said that every shout to be quiet or sit still or whatever there, that he would take that personally and think that they were definitely talking to him, you know. And I think that sometimes this practice can create those kinds of places of friction where we rub against it and realize, oh, it's not this, it's me.
One other thing that comes to mind for me is lately I've been practicing my guitar. I've played some pretty complicated pieces and stuff, but lately I've been finding what I want to do is these really simple rhythmic exercises. And and it reminds me of the form of the ritual in a way, because it's very sort of simple and you're doing a specific thing. But within that, I find that like every bar I do is different, you know, even though to an outside observer it would be exactly the same. They wouldn't hear any difference, but you know, somehow having a very simple external form, inside it there's a lot of nuance. Mm-hmm. And so I'm actually finding it more interesting to do that right now than play a complicated piece. There's just sort of more nuance to it.
And so what I'm making up from what you just said, inside the formal practice or the structure that we have, there's all this nuance that goes on for us.
I guess how I feel about it is that, yes, there always does need to be an examination of, is what we do hindering the Dharma, or is it helping the Dharma, or is it awash? I don't know, but I sort of do feel like the form strengthens the practice in the same way that if you put water through a hose versus through, I don't know, something big, you know, you get more pressure, you get more force, you get more opportunity for something.
I have to say, as a complete newcomer to all of this, that for me, there's so much history to this. There's so much, and for me, there's an issue of trust, which is that I see enough to believe that there's a lot more. And maybe that's not true, but I believe that there's a lot more. And so the form, to me, there's not a huge amount that is expected as part of joining the community in the forms, but it's resonates with that there's history to this, that there's a long past to this. Yes, there are divergences, blah blah blah, but there's a reason. I mean, there's an evolution. Not necessarily a reason, but there's a history, and so I think it's lovely. I think it's part of what, I mean, when a newcomer comes in, you know, the whole thing is something that can turn you off because it's foreign and you don't know what's going on and da 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 da. Not just the spirit principle, but the physicality of it are related.
I can relate to that. That when I first came, that it appealed to me as well, because Margaret and Steph took care to explain occasionally why are we doing this and why are we doing that, and or we would have these kind of discussions. Why do we bow to the door before we go into the into Daisan. And I love that idea that thousands of students before me, including Dogen, including the masters, bowed to the door before they went in. It's a way of tying, it ties me to them and them to me. Yeah. I'm feeling emotional. So I can relate
that's
to
how,
your
that's how,
history.
Yeah.
Today is, we were chanting, when I start to do something, I tend to do it really worried about doing it right. And so it's all about me doing it right and getting it right. And today, not just today, but particularly today, it gets more and more about, you know, when I'm, if I'm ringing the han, it's for everybody. It's not just... It's still me trying to do it right, but it's me doing it right, you know, for everybody. When I'm chanting, it's not just listening to me trying to say the words, it's listening to the whole voice, which is everyone here, that I become, that I am part of. That, and that'll make me emotional.
Getting that small self out of the way, huh? Yeah.
Something I remember from when I first came to Treetop was the forms were welcomed because I didn't know what I was doing there, and I didn't, you know, it was fearful, it was a scary situation, and so it was really helpful to have something that you could do. Even if you didn't know what else was happening, that you could bow and you could go through the service, and whatever else was happening, that was the scary stuff, but the form was solid, and I think that's valuable for some newcomers.
Riffing on the connecting us across the generations, I just come back to a story that Steph told in a session once about a prisoner that he had given Jukai to, and the guy had sewn a practice Rakusu out of the cloth from his mattress in his cell because he was so concerned about getting it right and he'd never sewn anything before, and Steph still had that practice Rakusu that the guy had made, but and how moved that guy was when he did his lineage chart to write down Huineng's name on his chart. And he said, you know, Mui, look, it's Huineng, and there's me, and, you know, and like, how big that is for a guy sitting in a jail cell in upstate New York to feel connected to an ancestor, you know, 2,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago, whatever.
I like your story about the practice Rasu. Remember that when you see mine.
No, the room. That's not the practice one.
Oh, that's it.
It was ticking. It was. I remember that.
Yeah,
he passed it around.
Yeah, it had a plastic, like a juice bottle ring.
Yeah, I don't remember the ticking.
I think so many, at least of my generation, and maybe of the newer generations too, maybe you can help with that, you youngsters here, but I think a lot of us have been wounded in the name of religion, and so I think that definitely affects people coming in, you know, affected by the more structure and the ritual and the process of it. But I'm not sure getting to, you know, I kind of like the middle way that we do our process, our structure, that we do hold it lightly, I think.
Yeah, well, because I don't think it's whether you have ritual or don't have ritual, or even how rigid you are about that ritual, or how many layers of ritual there are. I think it's the warmth of the human connections and telling people, oh, you know what? So you didn't hold your hands right. Whatever, you know, it's okay. None of us got it right the first time. And
it's possible to attach to ritual, and it's possible to attach to not having ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a lot of the sanghas, particularly the teacherless sanghas that have no ritual, they're often very attached to that. You know, mm-hmm. That's kind of, they don't want a teacher, they don't want this, they don't want to bow, they don't want to, you know. And they see that as freedom, but there's no freedom in being attached to, you know,
anything.
Yeah, you know, because they're now avoiding something. They're now both can happen. Both can happen. What was Jeremy? What was the word you used that Margaret said? Was it fufu or something? You said about it. If you we were Dyson, you said something. Margaret told you about sitting in. If you did more than that, you would get fufu.
I don't know if. She said those words. That was what I took away from it.
Okay.
That if I, when I was last here, Margaret, I was telling her that I don't have a practice, and she said, "Well, sit 15 minutes on your own, but don't sit more than that without a teacher, because you can go off into woo-woo land." But I don't think she said that. I can't say that she said.
You're paraphrasing her. Yeah. Okay. But that's the other point here. Diderot used to think that's what part of the function of the ritual was, to prevent us going off into woo land. You know, that, you know, we had to stay connected, we had to stay present, we had to be aware. If we just kind of went into this, you know, la la samadhi, then we couldn't do the things, you know, in the zendo correctly. So there's a way in which it could be seen as sort of medicine for that, keeping us grounded, keeping us from getting too foofy, you know, or woo-woo-y, or whatever the word is. Which is, again, one of the dangers of sort of teacherless, formless sangha, is, you know, getting kind of out there on the, I don't know what to call that, you know, sort of just losing our groundedness, losing the ground, you know. Just today worked on that koan with somebody about the woman comes out of samadhi, which many of you are familiar with, where, right, the paraphrase it, for those of you who haven't encountered it, is that there's a woman sitting at the foot of the Buddha's seat, and she's in deep samadhi, and Manjushri comes along, and the Buddha says, challenges him to wake her up, and Manjushri does his magic and takes her up to heaven and all these things, and he can't wake her up. And then the Buddha summons another bodhisattva, very minor. I mean, Manjushri is like rock star bodhisattva, and this is a very, very minor bodhisattva, and he dwells in a land that's deep, deep, deep down in the earth, thousands of Buddha lands down, whatever, 100, and so he's a very minor guy in a sense, and he comes up and he snaps his finger and the woman comes out of samadhi, right? And so, you know, the discussion we had is about, you know, that in many ways that he's coming from the earth. He has that earthy quality, that groundedness, that, you know, fundamental simplicity that Manjushri is all, you know, in this magical stuff, has lost. And so this woman responds to that direct earthy energy, not to the Manjushri's fufu energy. So I kind of hear a little bit of that in what we're talking about, you know. At a level, if we take it right, the form helps us to stay in that grounded space, that very concrete, elemental simplicity.
Creations are endless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are endless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.